I'm William O'Flaherty from All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast, now available through EssentialCSLewis.com. My guest is Charlie W. Starr, Professor of English and Humanities at Kentucky Christian University. As this interview is being recorded, his book was just released yesterday, so we're really privileged to have this exclusive interview. The title is simply Light, but have no fear, there is a subtitle, C.S. Lewis's First and Final Short Story. Welcome to the show, Charlie.
Thank you, William.
Well, let's kick things off by having you give a summary about the focus of the book by explaining the subtitle, How Can Someone's First Short Story Also Be Their Final Story?
Well, first short story in the sense that there's good evidence that this is the earliest short story we have of C.S. Lewis's, that he may very well have written this in the late 20s, even possibly before he was a Christian. A final short story in the sense that this is the version that Lewis wanted published all along. Now, there was a version of this story published in 1977 under the name The Man Born Blind. At that time, when Lewis's literary executor, Walter Hooper, published the story, it's the only version he had. It had no title, so it was a title that he gave it. But then a few years later, the Light manuscript suddenly appeared on the scene. And a good study, which is part of what I do in my book, shows that the Light manuscript truly is the version which follows the Man Born Blind version, and was the version most likely that Lewis intended to, the one that he really wanted to be published.
Now, how did you come across, as the promotional materials note, a unknown manuscript? What's the story behind your find?
Well, the unknown manuscript has been known since 1985, but nothing's really been done with it in terms of publication. The manuscript did pop up out of nowhere, and even in my investigation, I really didn't find out what happened to the manuscript than the fact that Lewis's stepson, Douglas Gresham, knew of its existence in the 1950s, and then the manuscript disappeared and did not reappear until 1985. It was picked up by some booksellers, a variety of booksellers in England. The Light manuscript was passed around by a number of London booksellers, the last of whom, Peter Jolliffe, eventually called Dr. Edwin W. Brown, who definitely wanted the Light manuscript, and he bought the Light manuscript then from Jolliffe. And so Ed had a hold of the manuscript in 1986, and after that he spent time working with it, authenticating it. Eventually, the Edwin Brown collection came to Taylor University, where we're sitting here right now doing this interview, and Taylor, of course, made the manuscript available for study. Well, I came to Taylor's colloquium on C.S. Lewis and Friends 2 years ago, and I got a chance to look at the Light manuscript and absolutely fell in love with it. And I said, something needs to be done with this. And so I went to Taylor and I said, why don't you all publish this? Why don't you do something in a book version, including as the first chapter, C.S. Lewis's Light story? And they said, well, why don't you write us a proposal and we'll let you know if we like it. And one thing led to another, and now Light is finally being published for all to read.
Now, this is obviously, as noted, a short story. Some may wonder why a short story warrants such a lengthy treatment. So tell us how your book is arranged to justify your discovery being a book and not something shorter like an article.
Well, the first chapter of the book, part one, we're saying, of the book, is just the Light story itself. We wanted to get the story out there. We wanted to say, here's the version that Lewis wanted published and give it to the folks to read. Part two of the book, then, is the fun mystery surrounding the Light story. Where did it come from? Where did it disappear to? Is it truly authentic? What is its relationship to the Man Born Blind version of the story? And the biggest mystery turned out to be, when was the story written? So I spent a great deal of time tracking down the evidence that would eventually lead to a conclusion which no one has yet come up with as to when the story was written. So a good chunk of the book dealt with that. Part three, then, is the interpretive section of the book. Now, in my original conception, I thought, well, there'll be one chapter on the meaning of the Light story. There ended up being four chapters on the meaning of the Light story. And I think that's primarily because of something that Owen Barfield, one of C.S. Lewis's closest friends, said about Lewis as a writer. He said, somehow what Lewis thought about everything was secretly present in what he said about anything. And I think that's true. When your listeners get a chance to take a look at the cover of the Light book, they'll see a man standing in a keyhole. And, of course, I didn't design the cover or anything, but I really think it's apt because light can be looked at as a key for understanding so much of C.S. Lewis's writing, from his epistemological thought to his ideas about longing and joy. Well, part four of the book, then, I'm really excited about, because we got permission to publish not only the light story, but the man born blind version of the story in parallel versions, including never before published revisions that Lewis was working on between The Man Born Blind and Light. And so readers can take a look at these in column form, side by side, run comparisons between them. And then what you realize after a careful study is that Lewis did have particular goals in his revision from the Man Born Blind version to the final Light version. And that comparison reveals new information about perhaps the meaning, the nature of the Light story.
Let's take a moment, if you don't mind, in regards to part three, the meaning of light. How can a short story have so many different possible interpretations without giving away the farm? Give us some summary thoughts about that.
Well, and it really is, I think, going to have to be sort of a flying over overview at 30,000 feet kind of approach. Owen Barfield established what he considered to be the meaning of the story early on, and critics, for the most part, accepted it, although a few critics suggested, well, Barfield was close to right, but it perhaps it could mean this. But essentially, Owen Barfield believed that the story was written in the late 20s, essentially for him. And I don't have any reason to doubt his testimony in that regard. But Barfield saw the story as being written as a kind of parable about philosophy. It was part of the Great War, as Lewis called it, between Barfield and himself that occurred through most of the 20s. After Barfield took up the anthroposophy of Rudolf Steiner and became an anthroposophist. So Barfield believed that the story was a message about epistemology and about the spiritual world. In talking about the idea, is it possible to get in touch with the world beyond, the transcendent, the cosmic logos, which Lewis had come to believe in before he became a Christian? Barfield said that through philosophical introspection, you could indeed get in touch with that higher logos, that higher world of soul. Lewis said, no, you can't. And he uses light as a metaphor for that. Light is not a thing you see. Light is the thing you see by. That, according to Barfield, was Lewis's point. Now, a few other critics have taken that and run with it in slightly different directions, but that's been the foundational approach to interpreting the text. Well, how does that then bear out in other Lewis texts? And it bears out very well. So you can look at Lewis's later writings and see that there are epistemological connections to the light story as Lewis continues to use the metaphor of light, especially in terms of this idea of looking at things versus looking along things. So again, you do see this in a number of Lewis writings many years later and throughout his life. The best example of this is probably his essay, A Meditation in a Tool Shed, where Lewis talks about being inside a tool shed, and he sees a single beam of light coming through, and he looks at the beam. But then when he steps into the beam and looks along the beam, he sees beyond the tool shed. He sees the trees. He sees the sky. And 60 million miles away, he sees the sun, and it's a completely different experience. So he uses that metaphor to talk about two different kinds of human knowing, the kind of knowing that comes from looking along versus the kind of knowing that comes from looking at. And he doesn't say that one is better than the other, although it does seem at times in various writings of his that he favors looking along. For example, in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, when the Dawn Treader has come to the island where dreams come true, the dark island, and in the midst of darkness and shadow, and they cry out to Aslan for help, and a single beam of light comes through, and they look along the beam, and they see this figure coming, the cross-shaped figure, which becomes the albatross, which is an embodiment of Aslan, and that ends up saving him. So at times Lewis seems to favor looking along, but he looks at looking along and looking at as legitimate forms of knowing, and the kind of knowledge that we're after then determines which kind of knowing is best. Well, you see this idea then manifested in other Lewis writings as well. Thus, for example, in his essay Myth Became Fact, he starts with the epistemological problem of knowing things by abstraction versus knowing things by experience, and how myth can help bridge the gap between those two things. So I discuss that then as well. I discuss a variety of Lewis sources. But then I don't leave it there. I wanted to end with another major Lewis metaphor, and that is of light as concrete reality. Light as a metaphor for the higher Platonic reality that's represented in the heavenly world. And that allows us perhaps a very different reading of the light story. And the reason I wanted to pursue that different reading is because ultimately what I discovered is that the light version of the story seems to be written by a very Christian Lewis. In fact, both the man born blind version of the story and the light versions that we have extant were not at all written in the late 20s before Lewis converted to Christianity. Now, I don't mean by that then that Owen Barfield was wrong. I simply mean that the versions we have were written later. And so if Lewis was rewriting the story when he was a Christian, he may have seen new meanings in it. And I think one of the meanings that he saw in it was a meaning involving this idea of longing, this desire for light. And so the hero of the story, Robin, is desperately looking for the light that is behind all things in the world, but he wants to see it. He thinks it's not just a thing that you should be able to look along. It's not just a thing that you should be able to see by, but it's a thing you ought to be able to see yourself. And I connect that then to Lewis's ideas in The Weight of Glory of our desire for God, manifested in our longing for beauty, and ultimately in our longing for that beauty to enter us in a very real and concrete way and fill us with the glory of God, which is, if you will, a desire to be filled with the light of God. And that's what Robin in the story wants as well. So multiple meanings in the light story, because very possibly Lewis meant multiple things by the story over several decades.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, I can't help but note, while encouraging people to read the essays that you did mention by Lewis, I do have a separate essay chat component to All About Jack, and we have discussed Myth Became Fact as well as Meditations in a Tool Shed. If it's not released yet, you'll see it shortly after in the next few weeks, so be sure to check that out as well. Getting back directly to the book Light by Dr. Charlie W. Starr, you were mentioning when I heard your lecture that there were some interesting people and places that you encountered in your research. Share us some about that.
Well, this is one of those dream opportunity projects when it comes along. You're working with original Lewis manuscript that's never been published, and you're the one who's going to get to publish it. And automatically, then, it means you want to go to some people who are going to really help you shed light on the light manuscript. Okay, I had to throw the pun in there once. There it is. I'll try not to do it again, but we'll see. So one of the first people I met who I just enjoyed spending time with was Ed Brown, who is responsible for the Brown collection at Taylor University. Ed is a true fan of C.S. Lewis and an avid collector of Lewis first editions and rare manuscripts. Ed is the first person to obtain the light manuscript for us here in the States, and he really did make the Lewis community aware of light before anyone else did. And so I got to go visit Ed in March of 2011 at his home, and I had a dozen questions to ask him. We spent a couple hours talking about my project, and then we went down into his basement and took a look at his wonderful collection of Lewis first editions and other memorabilia, and just had an absolutely terrific, terrific time reminiscing about someone we both care about so much, that we both have such a passion about. So I enjoyed Ed's company a great deal. On that same week I was on spring break, I was able to visit Taylor University for a day and look more carefully at the light manuscript, and then go on to Chicago to Wheaton College and the Wade Center, where there is this wonderful collection of C.S. Lewis manuscripts and additional work. And I was able there to consult with Marjorie Lamp Mead and Christopher Mitchell, two big names in the Lewis community and scholarship. And then I looked forward to the summer of 2011, when I was going to get to fly to England and spend a couple of weeks in Oxford to research at the Bodleian Library. And there again, meet some wonderful folks who are very much involved in Lewis. I got to have a dinner a couple of times with Michael Ward, who is the author of the Planet Narnia and Narnia Code books, and very well known worldwide for his work in that area, C.S. Lewis studies. And Michael gave me just some wonderful insights in terms of thinking about light as a metaphor that Lewis uses throughout his corpus, but then also about the individual light story itself. Certainly, though, the highlight of my experience was the day on Monday, I believe it was, well, it was in July, but I won't say the date. I'm not 100%. But it was a Monday, and I was invited by Walter Hooper to his house to have tea with him and Blessed Lucy of Narnia, his cat. And I arrived at Walter's house a full half hour early to make sure I could find the place. And I went and I knocked on the door, and the man I expected, the scholar, the deep thinker, the man who has done so much good work for Lewis studies, answered the door with this boisterous hello, and then he proceeded very quickly into a discussion with his cat on the fact that she could not go out of doors because they had to entertain a guest. It's the kind of conversation that you see a master having with his tail wagging dog, or a mother having with her 2-year-old, but it's the last kind of conversation you would expect of a Lewis scholar to be having with his cat. But here was Walter Hooper doing that very thing. He invited me into his home. He gave me tea and Lewis's favorite biscuits. He talked enthusiastically, had a wonderful sense of humor. He told Lewis stories as if he were telling them for the very first time, and I was the very first person he was telling them to. He showed me some wonderful Lewis artifacts, artwork and books that he has. And of course, then we had a great discussion on my questions about the Light manuscript, especially on the date of the manuscript. And his help was just absolutely phenomenal. So a fun experience. I got to visit the kilns while I was in Oxford and spend time with Debbie Higgins, the director of the kilns. Just great experiences overall while I was there.
Now, this is not your first book that you've written. You've written several others, only I think one related to Lewis you contributed to. So tell us about some of your other books.
Well, the book that I contributed to is a book called Revisiting Narnia, and I have an essay in there on, I think it's called The Silver Chair and the Silver Screen, and it's C.S. Lewis's theory of film, if he'd bothered to have one, is the idea of that book, and that's an essay in that book. I wrote a science fiction novel called The Heart of Light, which has been a lifelong project that I enjoyed working on. It's sort of like Conrad's Heart of Darkness, but with some grace, is the idea. I have a book called Life in the Spirit, which is a kind of Christianity 101 study of the first 8 chapters of Romans, built especially for people who just don't like to read. But a good study if you want to look at Christian basics, learn some Christian basics. It's a good study and a quick study. In 2005, Nav Press published my book, Honest to God, Wrestling Your Way to Intimacy with the Creator. And in this book, I talk about a problem that I don't think it's talked about enough. Sometimes in life, we have difficulties, we have hardships, but what do you do as a Christian when you realize you have a problem and the problem you have is God? Who do you take that to? Who do you tell about that? Do you even tell God, or are you afraid that he's going to strike you down because you're angry at him, because you have issues with him? What fellow Christian do you tell when they say, well, how are you doing today, Brother Charlie? And they say, well, I'm fine, but I'm really mad at God right now. You don't just walk up to people and say that sort of thing. Well, Honest to God is a study of characters in the Bible who wrestled with God. And they aren't abnormal, and they're not weird, and they were people of faith, so much so that God even gave them the name Israel, God Wrestler. If you have issues with God, this is a book to read to let you know you're not alone, and to let you know that there's a way to work through it, and that God really wants you to work through those issues, even if the issues you have are with him. And my most recent book here, just a couple years ago, is a children's book for grown-ups too, and it's King Lesserlight's Crown. And in the story, King Lesserlight lives in Greytown near the Long and Misty Mountains, and one day a terrible gloom comes to steal King Lesserlight's heart and replaces it with an old ticking clock. And King Lesserlight does not know that his heart has been replaced because he still feels something beating inside. But he has to find out why he has lost his joy before the clock runs down. And so he goes searching to find out what has happened with his joy, and he meets a variety of characters. And among the funnest of those characters that your listeners will be interested in is a man named Jack. And King has a wonderful set of conversations with Jack in the middle of the book that allow him to continue on his journey till he can finally find his way to joy again.
Well, speaking of Jack, Many authors, I will ask the question about how they came to enjoy C.S. Lewis' work, so I'll ask you that question as well.
Well, you know, I love books, I love literature, but I didn't really start loving them till I was in college, and among the people who turned me on to literature was definitely C.S. Lewis. My freshman year in college, I just suddenly decided that it would be cool to be smart. And so I started reading, and among the first things I read then were Lewis's space trilogy, and then the Chronicles of Narnia, which I devoured the summer of my freshman year. And I read some other Lewis pieces, Mere Christianity, and various of the apologetical works. But I've always liked C.S. Lewis. Now, I didn't really just dive into Lewis, though, at that time in my life. Every now and then I would see a Lewis book and I said, no, I think I'll grab that and I'll read that, and I would certainly enjoy it. But the book that really sort of set me over the top with Lewis was Till We Have Faces. After I'd studied literature a little bit more and really learned what literature's for and learned about the power of imagination as a mode of knowing, I read Till We Have Faces in the late 80s, perhaps the early 90s, and I said, this book is transcendent. This book is more than anything else Lewis has done. This is the kind of book that will make me fall in love with this man's writing for the rest of my life. I mean, I don't know that I said that consciously, but certainly that was the final result. And Till We Have Faces is the thing that made me a permanent C.S. Lewis fan. After that, then I had to read absolutely everything that he ever wrote that I could get my hands on.
Well, that was going to be part of my question. Is Till We Have Faces then the one that you've enjoyed the most, it sounds like, but has there been any more recent, so many individuals I've interviewed, they said, well, this historically has been the one that was the most profound early on, but then later there have been others that I've enjoyed in the last few years. What in the last few years then has it been especially meaningful to you in regards to Lewis's writings?
Well, I will probably always pick Till We Have Faces as my favorite book. I'm a huge fan of The Great Divorce. I love the Narnia books. I love Perelandra. This last fall, I had the first opportunity in my life to teach a graduate course, and it was a graduate course in C.S. Lewis. And though I teach an undergraduate course in Lewis's fiction works, here I had a chance to teach a grad course in Lewis's theological works. And so I just really enjoyed rereading a number of those works, which I really haven't been able to get in touch with for several years, and some of them to be able to read in first editions. I'm just taking a first edition off the shelf, whether it was one in my school's library or one that I'd managed to find somewhere, and to read through The Four Loves or Reflections on the Psalms or Mere Christianity, and to read it in those old editions with the wonderful old book smell that goes with them and the feel of the pages. That was what was a really wonderful experience. Of course, the content's fantastic too, which is the experience of reading a book that Lewis himself would have seen and would have known his friends to be reading was really enjoyable to me.
Well, as we wrap up with Charlie W. Starr, he does have a website, and I just gave you all the information that you need to know to get to his site, and that is charliewstarr.com. Well, Charlie, any final thoughts about Lewis or your book?
Well, if you're a mild Lewis fan, keep reading your C.S. Lewis because he is still so relevant and so important. He's prophetic so that in our own day, he still has things to speak to us. If you are a serious Lewis fanatic, then you want to dive into the mystery of light. I'd say you're just not finished with your pursuit of C.S. Lewis until you've read Light, C.S. Lewis's first and final short story.
All right. Well, thanks again, Charlie. We appreciate you being here for All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast now available through EssentialCSLewis.com. Thanks again, Charlie.
Thank you.